You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Happy Friday, everybody. My name is Mike Cutler. I am not Tom Garcia, but I am filling in for him as I have been and will continue to do so for the rest of this summer, while Tom hopefully is going to enjoyable places and having the time of his life, because I wish that for everybody out there. Again, my name is Mike Cutler. I'm glad you're here. I welcome you to join me and my co-host, Paula Lazan Ostman. This is the American Hour radio program. Tom is an American Airlines pilot, as no doubt you know, and he's also a former naval aviator, former instructor at Top Gun. My background is a bit different. I was an immigration agent for nearly 30 years. I've done a bunch of congressional hearings, and my focus, for the most part, is on what is going on in the world of immigration, border security, and a host of issues that relate back to how our country is addressing the challenges, or perhaps not addressing the challenges, that have been created for our nation because for a bunch of reasons our borders are not secure, our immigration system has no integrity, there are millions of illegal aliens in our country today whose true identities are unknown and unknowable, and these issues hammer everything from national security, criminal justice, and community safety to the economy, the environment, healthcare, and education. And on talk radio, we get to discuss those issues that so many folks in the so-called mainstream media won't go near with a 10-foot pole. They think it's radioactive. And, you know, Jack Nicholson in that great movie, A Few Good Men, said, "You can't handle the truth." In point of fact, I believe that we, the people, must have the truth. And talk radio and the Internet are the ideal ways of communicating today. You know, if you look at the First Amendment of our Constitution, a document that perhaps should be required reading for all of our elected representatives, you will see that the First Amendment doesn't only talk about freedom of speech, but it also talks to the issue of the right to peaceably assemble. Now, that's a very important concept, ladies and gentlemen, because the right to peaceably assemble means that we can get together and have these discussions. At the time of the founding of this great nation, hard to believe, but it won't be long before it's a quarter of a millennium ago, there was no technology to speak of. If people wanted to have a discussion, a debate, an argument, whatever, there were no telephones, there were no computers. They had to stand nose-to-nose, face-to-face, and have at it. Yes, they could write letters, but boy, could you imagine waiting for the Pony Express to bring one missive and another one and back and forth. So the only real way of communicating was in person. And that's what this concept of the right to peaceably assemble is. When our country was founded, people would meet under shade trees. They would meet in people's homes. They might meet in a church or a synagogue or a school, but the idea was they got to meet person to person. Today we still do that, and we still meet in all those venues, but the best place of all is the Internet, because people from all over the world, literally, can get their voices heard, can be out here, have these discussions, and perhaps come away with a much better understanding of the issues. And even if we get to disagree, in disagreement, I think there's greater understanding also. And that's our duty, to have the discussions, to disagree perhaps, but to disagree with respect for one another and with a bit of courtesy, because I think the rancor of the time has gotten to an unacceptable level. And you can join the conversation. You can call us at 310-982-4145. Grab your crayon. Let me give you the number again. Jot it down. Call us at 310-982-4145. Paula, how are you this Friday?
Doing excellent, Mike. It's good to be back on Friday.
Good. Good to have you back. I was flying solo last week. It wasn't nearly as much fun.
Oh, stop.
Well, you know, then you, when you do it by yourself, you kind of almost think you're talking to yourself, and I do that often enough as it is.
Well, at least there's nobody there to talk back to you.
You'd be amazed. And, you know, the more you read the newspaper headlines, folks, the more you really do want to start talking to yourself. You know, I usually focus on immigration, but I also do look at the border. And there has been, for those of you not paying attention, some real madness taking place along our border right now. And let me tell you, when you read this stuff in the newspapers and when you see the hearings and the coverage of it, you really have to ask yourself, what in the world were these people thinking about within the administration over at ATF, the Justice Department, and increasingly maybe even the FBI and DEA and God knows where else this bouncing ball will take us. And, of course, you know, what we're talking about is Operation Fast and Furious. For those of you not familiar with Fast and Furious, and by the way, I would urge you to please go to my website. Again, get that trusty crayon out. My website is michaelcutler.net, michaelcutler, michaelcutler.net. That's one word. Or you can go to CAPS Web, C-A-P-S, CAPSWeb.org. CAPS, of course, is Californians for Population Stabilization. I'm proud to be a senior fellow with that organization, and they do great work because their concern is the same concern that I have, specifically the failures to secure the borders and have an immigration system that not only has integrity, but in so doing and protects us, but also honors all those millions of immigrants who came here legally, and they and their descendants who built this great nation. So, you know, I always like to tell people, by the way, if there's any doubt in your mind, the difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. You know, we all love to have company visits, but not when the folks crawl through our bedroom window at 3 o'clock in the morning. But anyway, just to go into this Operation Fast and Furious, ATF apparently, for I'm not even sure how long, and this will unfold, I hope, as the investigations and the hearings continue, but they engaged in an undercover investigation where they allowed what they call straw purchasers to go into gun shops not far from the Mexican border and buy up lots of guns and walk out the door with those firearms. And for those of you who aren't familiar with a straw purchaser, we're not talking about a scarecrow. You know, this isn't the Wizard of Oz. But a straw purchaser is somebody who comes in but really isn't buying the guns for himself. He's buying them for someone else. And we all have experienced this. You know, college kids may have a friend who's old enough to buy cigarettes, get the cigarettes and give it to them, or buy a bottle of beer and bring it to them, which, of course, is illegal, by the way. But that's the concept. Some guy with a criminal history wants to get his hands on the guns. And in this case, the people with the criminal histories are believed to have actually been, and think about this one, the Mexican cartels. And it wasn't a matter of buying one or two firearms. Apparently, we are talking about hundreds, if not thousands. These weren't just revolvers. We're talking about AK-47s, assault rifles, 50-caliber machine guns. Now, what's astonishing to me, because I've worked very closely with ATF, DEA, FBI, local and state police. I was part of the drug task force for 10 years. Before that, for 4 years, I was assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of DEA, where we worked with everybody from everywhere, even foreign governments. I've worked closely with the Israeli National Police, the Japanese Police, the Canadian Royal Canadian Mounted Police, British Customs and New Scotland Yard. So I've seen the overview. And what happened here is such a foul-up of such monumental, indeed galactic proportions. I got to tell you, folks, I am sitting here reading these articles, and I have to hang on to my face and keep my jaw from hitting the ground in front of me. Because when you allow bad guys to walk out the door with fully functioning firearms, then you have to say to yourself, what on earth are you thinking about? The whole idea to conducting an investigation into firearms is to get the guns off the street, not to put them back out on the street, especially not to put them into the hands of what is arguably the most vicious, pernicious, and violent of all criminal organizations that I have ever been aware of, and that's Los Zetas, which are these drug traffickers who, by the way, here we go again, we trained and equipped. The United States, working in conjunction, allegedly, with Mexico, trained Mexico's elite police and military units, taught them our tactics, gave them, if you will, our playbook, and said, this is how we combat drug trafficking in America, and this is what you need to do in Mexico so you can help win the war on drugs. Well, that's certainly a worthwhile goal, but guess what happened? In short order, these elite military and police officers who underwent that training and were given those weapons were approached by the cartels, and they said, how would you like to work for us as an enforcer? We'll pay you 10 times what the government pays you. We'll pay you 20 times. Because for these folks, money was no object. So initially, Los Zetas became the enforcers for the cartels in Mexico. And after a while, as often happens, greed took over. And they said, wait a minute, why are we working for them? We can put them out of business and take over their market. And that's exactly what they've done. And in furtherance of their criminal objectives, if you've been following the news, anywhere from 35,000 to 40,000 people have been killed in Mexico by the Mexican cartels just in the last couple of years since Felipe Calderon, the current president of Mexico, took office. This is a level of violence that is astonishing. Mexico is in a state of free fall and teeters on the potential of becoming a failed state. And now it is turning out that the weapons that were used may well have been provided to Los Zetas by the government of the United States through this wacky investigation. And you sit here saying, how could that be? You know, when the FBI does a sting investigation, and we've all seen it, they hear that some guy wants to bomb a building, wants to do this or wants to do that. What they generally do is give this guy inert chemicals and tell him, oh, this is an explosive compound. Okay? They'll tell him that we'll give you a detonator and the detonator doesn't work. They make sure that even if the guy puts all the pieces of this bomb together, when he pushes the button, nothing happens. These guns, folks, were fully operational. And, you know, if these were hand grenades, the potential for human tragedy would not be as great. And if you wonder how that's possible, think about it. If you put the hand grenade in the hands of a bad guy, he goes into a room, he pulls the pin, he throws the grenade, he runs away, 10 people are killed, 12 people are wounded, it's horrific, it's terrible, it's awful, it's a tragedy, but the grenade is gone. He can't use it anymore. These guns will be out there, folks, for decades, as long as people will be able to find the ammunition to put into these guns. They will be able to kill with them. It's entirely possible that 100 years from now, people will still be getting killed by some of these firearms that the government of the United States of America put into the hands of the cartels. And understand that the cartels today aren't only operating in Mexico. Janet Napolitano, this genius, goodness gracious, has told us the border is secure, okay? But somehow with that secure border, according to NAPI, 230 American cities or more are now infested by the Mexican cartels. 230 American cities. What does that mean? It means they're operating here. How do they operate? Well, they bring their dope up here that the dopes use, who use the drugs. I call them the dopes. And then they get the money and send it home. But it's not quite that simple. You see, when I was up at DEA Intelligence, now when I was part of the Drug Task Force, I spent 14 years where virtually every day I worked on either narcotics investigations or terrorism investigations, we saw the violence. Some smart guy thinks, well, I'll skim some money off of this drug sale. The guy that he reports to figures it out. This guy winds up dead. His wife and children wind up dead. There was one case I was involved with many years ago before I was on the Drug Task Force where they slaughtered one of these characters' wives and two little babies. He found the children with their throats slashed, and they were under 3 years of age. His wife was raped, and then they put a plastic bag over her head and suffocated her, left the three bodies in a nearby school. In fact, one child was hanging from the gate, from the fence outside the school with a note pinned to its naked chest. This is the level of violence we're talking about. And this was back in the 80s, or, yeah, I guess this was around 1980 when I encountered that case, or earlier. It's only gotten worse. The beheadings, the beheadings of bodies, and then they hang the bodies today off of bridges with graffiti on the bodies, telling the whole world, you mess with us, you'll be the next guy to be hung from a bridge without your head. These are the people that this investigation provided with firearms. So when you look at all of this, you say to yourself, why would you do it? Why wouldn't you at least stop the people as they're coming out with the guns? You now have him. You could do that. We've done it with drug investigations. They call these controlled deliveries. The guy comes, he pays the money, you give him the firearms, he puts them in the car, you arrest him. The guns go nowhere, and he goes to jail unless he wants to become a cooperator. And then he introduces you to the next guy up the chain of command, and you do something similar, and that's how you work your way up the chain of command. That's a legitimate, appropriate, reasonable law enforcement tactic for conducting an undercover gun investigation. You could do it with any contraband. It could be explosives. It could be narcotics. Doesn't matter. It could be stolen property. You let the guy make the purchase. The money changes hands. He gets to the car. Bango. You got him. He consummated the deal. He's now violated the law. Why on earth would you allow, and we're not talking one or two guns, or maybe there was a mistake made. This happened repeatedly again and again and again. And if you watch the hearings, and the hearings are on videotape, you can see the hearing. Daryl Issa over in the House and Chuck Grassley, United States Senator over in the Senate, have been hammering away at this. And Issa held a hearing, and I watched that hearing several weeks ago, because one of the people killed by those guns was United States Border Patrol Agent Brian Terry. Now think about Mr. Terry, Agent Terry. He was a military guy, and when he got out of the military serving in the Middle East, he wanted to continue to serve America. This guy is a hero. He's a great American. He is a role model for these idiots in Washington. And he said, you know, I haven't done enough for my country. So he joins the Border Patrol, but it wasn't enough to be in the patrol. He joins BORTAC. BORTAC is the Border Patrol Tactical Unit. They're so good at what they do that George W. Bush said, you know what? The hell with securing America's border. We'll send BORTAC to secure the Iraqi border because God knows we can't defend Iraq if their border isn't secure. But the hell with America's border. It's both sides of the aisle, folks. Nobody gets a free pass from Mike Cutler, especially today on this issue. So Brian Terry became part of BORTAC. And on December 15th last year, his last day at work, before he was scheduled to take a flight to be with his family for Christmas holiday up in Michigan, he was on patrol along the Mexican border, and these thugs came across the border. He wound up being killed by a gun, I believe it was an AK-47, that was walked in this case. We put the gun in the hand of the guy who killed United States Border Patrol Agent Brian Terry. And if you watch this tape, please go to my website, michaelcutler.net. If you want to reach me, you can reach me through the website. Brian Terry, his mom and his sister and his cousin, who, by the way, is a federal agent as well, his cousin is a Secret Service agent, did an amazing job of testifying at that hearing. And there's a lot of pressure at those hearings. In fact, I've testified before 15 congressional hearings. I was actually forced out of my agency for daring to testify before Congress without the authorization of my agency in the wake of 9/11. I would do it all over again tomorrow morning. My dad used to say you could tell who a real man is. He stands for something. Well, Brian Terry stood for something. He stood for America. And he paid with his life because our government doesn't seem to stand for much anymore. If I sound angry, you better believe I'm furious. Fast and furious. Well, that describes me today. Absolutely furious. Because this didn't have to happen. And it wasn't only Brian Terry. It is now believed that when Jaime Zapata, who was a ICE agent working in Mexico without firearms, because the Mexican government doesn't care if we're diplomats, we won't tolerate your people being armed, even if you have a diplomatic passport. Oh, this is Mexico, you know, the land of tranquility and security. So Jaime Zapata and his partner, Avila, were ambushed. And it turns out that Zapata was killed. And a couple of days ago, they announced how one of the ringleaders of this whole deal was arrested. This guy, Jesus Enrique Rejon Aguilar. He was a member of Los Zetas. He had been a, you know, one of these heavy hitter law enforcement or military types from Mexico. We trained him, we equipped him, and then he became one of the main founders and leaders of this drug cartel. And if you look at his picture, by the way, folks, he has a baby face. And you know, I hear this nonsense, well, you know, he doesn't look Mexican, you know, kind of thing. Well, Mexicans aren't this. And you can't look at a person and determine what their nationality is. Believe me, I've arrested thousands of illegal aliens from every country on this planet, and I can tell you with absolute certainty, you cannot sit across the table from another human being and say, oh, yeah, that guy's from Guatemala, this guy is from Iran, that guy's from Pakistan, and this guy is from Jamaica. It doesn't work that way. If you look at this picture of Jesus Enrique Rejon Aguilar, this guy could pass for anything. He certainly does not look sinister, yet he was the guy, according to reports I have read, who arranged for the ambush of Zapata and his partner in Mexico. Now, what's remarkable was they videotape an interrogation session with him, this ringleader, and he makes this statement that absolutely blows my mind. Because, let me read this sentence to you from this report that was in the Washington Times, written by a friend and someone I have tremendous respect for, a journalist by the name of Jerry Sieper. Jerry Sieper is now the investigative editor for the Washington Times. He's been covering the immigration beat for well over a decade. He's one of the most experienced voices out there. And so here's a sentence from this article that appeared yesterday. Meanwhile, Thursday, Mexican police released a videotape interview of Jesus Enrique Rejon Aguilar, in which the recently captured number three leader of Los Zetas drug cartel said, quote, all the weapons, unquote, that the Zetas used were bought in the United States and that even the American government itself was selling the weapons. Now, I want you just to stop right now and think of the words. I know I've been running my mouth, and maybe after a while it's like white noise. I want to stop. I want you to think about what I just said to you. I'm going to repeat it. Just please pay attention to these words. Here is what Jesus Enrique Rejon Aguilar had to say. Now, he's the number three leader of Los Zetas, the most violent and pernicious bunch of drug thugs in probably the world, certainly in Mexico, and that puts them way up there or maybe way down there. And he said during a videotaped interrogation that, quote, unquote, all the weapons the Zetas used were bought in the United States and that even the American government itself was selling the weapons. If this was an undercover operation, ladies and gentlemen, how did what had to be one of the primary targets of the investigation know that the guns were coming from the American government? The whole point to an undercover investigation is that that sort of information should never be leaked. Is there a mole in the Justice Department? Is there a mole in ATF? They say that possibly DEA and the FBI were involved in the investigation. Did they leak the information? Was this really an undercover operation? Was this simply a way of funneling firearms to the cartels? You know, I hear this nonsense about the war on drugs, and I feel as though my head is going to explode. I have lost friends in law enforcement who were engaged in narcotics investigations. There's a guy by the name of Everett Hatcher. I used to call him Hatch. I knew Hatch for about 15 years. Everett Hatcher was killed back in 1988 or 1989. Forgive me, at the moment I don't recall, but I do remember that he was killed on February 28th. And I was with him 3 hours before he was shot to death. At the time, I was assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of the DEA in New York. I walked into my office, and guess who's sitting at my desk with his feet up on my desk but Everett Hatcher. And there's Hatch, and I said to him, what on earth are you doing sitting at my desk? And ironically, of all the things he could have said to me, that day Hatch said to me, Mike, how would you like to trade jobs? A few hours later, I was watching TV, speaking with a friend on the telephone, and a little crawler, a little bulletin went across the bottom of my TV screen. Now, I didn't know where he was going. I did know that he had an undercover meet that day. And this little crawler goes across the bottom of my television, and it says, DEA agent shot in Staten Island. The next day, to my horror, to my grief, one of my closest friends in law enforcement, Everett Hatcher, was shot to death by a member of organized crime, the Italian mob in Staten Island, as he sat in the car after the meeting. They snuck up behind him and put two rounds in the back of his head, widowed his wife, orphaned his two young boys. I was at DEA when President George Bush Sr. came to DEA to pay tribute to Hatch. Bob Stuttman, who at the time was a special agent in charge of the DEA office in New York, was kind enough, because he knew we were such good friends, he wouldn't allow me to participate in the field investigation into the murder to try to capture the guy that did it, the guy by the name of Gus Faraci, who was ultimately killed by the Italian mafia, because the heat was on and they just couldn't deal with the heat anymore, so they gave him up. But in their own inimitable way, they killed him and left his body where he'd be found easily. Bob Stuttman called me in. He said, Mike, you're too close to Hatch. I am afraid that if you're out there with your anger and emotions flying the way they are, that you might get yourself into trouble. So you come into my office every Friday. We'll have a cup of coffee. I will fill you in on where the investigation is going. And he did. And on the day that George Bush came to New York, he provided me with a front row seat where normally, as a member of an outside law enforcement agency, I would have been sitting in the back of the room. He put me in the third row right behind the director of the New York office of the FBI. I don't believe Bob is listening, but Bob, if you are, I just want you to know I will never forget that gesture. It was a tough day for all of us. And I was there when George Bush came back to New York when they opened the new office for DEA, and they named the street right in front of the DEA office Everett Hatch, Special Agent Everett Hatcher Way. But the point is, Hatch is gone. And the point is, what was the purpose of these investigations if the drugs are still flowing into our country, across our borders, poisoning our children, ruining lives? It's estimated that perhaps 70 or 75% of all crime in our country, directly or indirectly, is related to narcotics, the violence, the fact that people who get hooked are done. We had informants who were drug addicts. If you want to talk about Humpty Dumpty, you can't put them back together. These drug addicts were done. Stick a fork in them. They were fully baked, fully done. And what are we doing to combat drug use in America? The food police would probably sooner arrest somebody for putting a salt shaker in their lunchbox than if they saw somebody walking around with a quantity of drugs. At least that's the impression you get from the news. You turn on the television, and it seems like at least a quarter of the commercials are about some pharmaceutical that you can't pronounce and you're supposed to have a prescription for anyway, and if you take it, your body parts will start to fall off and you'll lie on the floor writhing in pain and die. But this is a great drug to take. But when was the last time you saw a concerted effort, folks, to tell young people in particular, stay away from this poison? You know, Stuttman made an interesting point when he was the head of DEA. I went with him to a number of the presentations that he gave. At the time, I was assigned to the intelligence unit of his office. He said, you know, when I started working for DEA, I meaning Bob Stuttman, he said, drug use was rare in America. If somebody had dropped a kilo of cocaine on a street corner, people would have been calling up and saying, please, you got to sweep this garbage up and hose down the street. He said now, and this now, by the way, was over 20 years ago, he said we've gotten to the point where if you drop that kilo of cocaine on the street corner, you better call the riot cops, because half the neighborhood is going to be out on all fours with a straw stuck in their nose, and they'll try to inhale the damn garbage. What is going on? If we are going to win this war on drugs, we have to interdict it. Yes. If we're going to win the war on drugs, we've got to go after the traffickers. Absolutely. But could you imagine if no one used this garbage, if they brought it in here and there was nobody to sell it to, all the profits would be gone? You know, people say, well, isn't the solution legalizing? I have a better solution, folks. I have a better solution. Convince people to not get hooked on this crap in the first place. Why in blazes would anybody want to put this poison into their bodies that screws up their brains, screws up their health, creates an addiction where when they wake up in the morning, the most important issue for them once they relieve themselves, and maybe even before they relieve themselves, is where they're going to get their money for their next fix. It leads to prostitution. It leads to crime, to robberies, to burglaries, to assaults. I mean, this is a societal rot. And I want to know the last time you saw a leader of our country stand before those cameras, and they all love the cameras, don't they? They stand in front of those forests of microphones, don't they? Because it's all about publicity and images and, hey, ma, look at me. When was the last time, folks, you tell me, that you saw an alleged leader stand in front of those damn microphones and deliver a clear and unambiguous message? Stop using this garbage. Stop funding the narco-terrorists and the other terrorists, because we know there have been so many newspaper articles linking Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations, even Al-Qaeda, with the drug trade. When was the last time you saw anybody? Have you ever seen Obama do that? Did you ever see George Bush do it, senior or junior? It's very rare to see a politician stand in front of those microphones and say to the American people, knock it off. Did you ever see Bill Clinton do that? Al Gore, Mr. Global Warming himself? Folks, we have a lack of leadership in America. That's pretty obvious. I listen to Bill Maher and these other pundits who don't know which end is up. And by the way, so that you know, I'm not a political conservative. I'm a lifelong Democrat. I just think the Democratic Party needs a new GPS because those idiots are lost. But to say that the Tea Party is purely about the right wing nuts, you know, 2 years ago I went to Dallas, Texas, and I had the privilege of addressing, gosh, I was told there might have been 20,000 people in the audience in Dallas, and boy, was it hot. It was about 105 degrees. I thought I landed in an oven. But I will tell you, after I spoke, so many people came up to me and we chatted. It was one of the most amazing days of my life. And do you know that probably half the people I encountered were disgusted Democrats? The Tea Party, folks, is a vote for none of the above. It's a vote for none of the above. What we have been witnessing is the selling of our country. And that's where we are today. So we have the drug money being used to purchase the firearms being used to kill people, including our agents, and undoubtedly, eventually, people living inside the United States. I'd love to see what happens every time there's a homicide and a murder weapon is recovered. But then again, with this government, the likelihood that they're going to even tell you what the source of the guns was, I'm not holding my breath. You know, when Russia was the Soviet Union, the media was controlled by the government. Pravda, Izvestia, you know, the two great news organizations of the Soviet Union. It was all about propaganda, all about propaganda. Are we much better than that today? Really, are we? Is it easy to get news out of our news organizations today, the honest news, the news that everybody wants? There's a terrible murder trial in Florida. Yes, it was horrific. I'm of the belief, however, that you have to believe in the system. If the woman was acquitted, she was acquitted. Get over it, and let's move on. But think of how much airtime has been spent on that case. And then the day afterwards, I was listening to these people, and there's a wonderful Yiddish term, yenta, which is like a nosy body. The so-called journalists of the day were conducting themselves not as journalists, but as yentas. Well, do you think she'll be able to go back to live with her dad now that she said these terrible things about him? Well, the father is dysfunctional. I don't know. This is a terrible family. Folks, could you imagine Eric Severide or Walter Cronkite doing that kind of a news report? Edward R. Murrow. Could you imagine Edward R. Murrow standing before the microphones and making a statement like that? This isn't news, folks. It's a sideshow. It's a freak show. It's anything but what really matters. And that's why I come back again to the importance of talk radio, the internet, the ability for folks to really have a discussion and really exchange information. And you know, so many talk show hosts speak from an abundance of no knowledge. I always try to keep it real. If I'm going to offer an opinion, then I want to offer an opinion where I have some expertise. I mean, yes, certain things are pretty obvious, and that makes sense. It's obvious, for example, that today the space shuttle was launched on its last mission. It's, I think, a huge mistake that there's nothing in the wings ready to replace it. America is on decline. And it's in decline because we, the people, have failed to take our obligations seriously, to get our voices heard, and to make our politicians accountable. And that's really where we are, folks. The fact that the leaders of Los Zetas apparently was fully aware of an undercover operation and was even talking about the fact that he knew the source of the guns, that's not an undercover operation. That's a compromised investigation. A final thought, and then I want to get back to my co-host. I know I've been going on forever here. And by the way, you can join the conversation at 310-982-4145. But I just want you to know that most law enforcement agencies have adopted a whole host of policies to protect public safety. A lot of communities try to get away from high-speed chases. They use spike strips when a car tries to get away from the police. You know why they use the spike strips? Because they were finding out, if I remember my statistic correctly, that 1 in 10 high-speed chases resulted in a terrible crash, which may have caused people their lives, or at the very least, got people seriously injured, paralyzed, missing limbs, you know, the carnage that ensues from a high-speed chase. We don't put guns in the hands of bad guys. We don't let bad guys who are planning a bank robbery to pull off the bank robbery so law enforcement can go out there and say, well, we caught him after he robbed the bank. That would be reckless beyond words. What you need in a conspiracy, and just to give you a quick insight for those of you who don't have a legal or a law enforcement background, is you need an overt act. If three guys sit around saying, let's rob the first bank of Omaha, be there such a place, well, that discussion is not a crime. Anybody could say that. So now you need that first overt act, and one guy stands up and says, I'll tell you what we're going to do, guys. I'm going to rent a car, we'll take the license plates off, and then we'll go get some guns, and then we're going to rob the bank. So he rents the car, he starts taking the license plates off the car. You've got that audio or the videotape because they've been surveilled, and he's rented that car, he's taking off the license plate. You got him, because he said, to rob the bank, here's the strategy. We rent the car, take off the license plates. You don't let them rob the bank and maybe kill a bunch of people. But that's what they did here. You know, in my commentary, I made the point that doctors at least used to, I don't know if they still do, used to take the Hippocratic Oath that in part said, first do no harm. Folks, law enforcement has to follow that credo. First do no harm. First make certain that no matter how important that investigation is, don't do something that has the potential for getting a lot of people killed or even one person killed. That is not what law enforcement is about. Think of that sign that you see on all those LAPD cars, to protect and serve. I would love to be able to ask Mr. Holder, how were we being protected as this investigation was being carried out? Wouldn't that be a really fascinating question? How was this being carried out so that people were being protected? And you know, what's also very, very interesting is the fact that the acting head of the ATF is not going with the program. Apparently, Mr. Melson was supposed to go and talk to members of the congressional committees, ICE's committee in particular, but only with Justice Department lawyers. And believe me, folks, that if the DOJ would send their lawyers, they would have muzzled him. So what did he do? He said, I'm not going to be your fall guy. And on July 4th, and I, by the way, can't imagine a better way of celebrating America's birthday, he went and sat down with ICE's investigators, perhaps with Grassley's investigators, with his own lawyer that he paid for himself, who was certainly there to cover his best interests, which is understandable, and he gave, in secret, a statement and subjected himself to an interview. I can only imagine how many people right now are squirming like crazy over at the DOJ. You know, when I was a kid, they used to have this dance, the limbo, and the guy would say, how low can you go? Well, where this investigation's concerned, I think the real question is how high will it go? What do you think, Paula? I'm sorry for having gone on for so long, but there's so much I wanted to get out there for our listeners.
No, and it's, You know what? It's very important because you had made mention of, you know, the presidents that don't, you know, talk about, you know, the drugs and they don't put things out there and all sorts of things. And it takes people such as yourself to begin the forums and to blog and to put out there what's actually going on. And it makes me wonder sometimes, you know, are they afraid of the drug cartel? I mean, they're so powerful, Mike, that, you know, one wrong slip up by, you know, the president, the vice president, or anyone for that matter. I mean, you don't know. We don't know what they're capable of, or we do. I mean, if you Google.
No, we know what they're capable of, but here's the deal, too.
Right.
You know, as an agent, and I'm sitting here sipping my cup of tea, as an agent, I would not have been allowed to accept that cup of tea from somebody. It was so stringent, and I understand it, and I agree with it. I'll tell you how stringent it was. I almost like the Johnny Carson thing. How stringent was it? We were told that if we went to someone's house, and if I knocked on a guy's door because the guy living down the block from him was maybe the target of an investigation, that what I was supposed to do was to, you know, if they invited me in for a cup of coffee, say, you know what, folks, thank you for the hospitality, but a glass of ice water would be perfect. And the reason is that once you accept anything from someone, there always seems to be this idea, oh, well, he's my buddy now, you know, he'll take care of me. And if I need a favor, I can call him up now. And you don't want to be in that uncomfortable situation. Now, if an agent or a police officer is not supposed to accept a cup of coffee, a glass of soda, okay, whatever, you explain to me how politicians can take thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. The Supreme Court, in fact, last year, probably one of its worst rulings ever, said that corporations can give unlimited money now to campaign to fund campaigns. Well, when people get that kind of money, don't you think that there's a quid pro quo, that there's an expectation that if I give you this check, I am going to get some? You know, you write a check for $200 for some guy running for Congress because you think the guy's a good guy. You're not expecting much for that $200. You know, maybe you're expecting that, you know, he'll sit down with you one day and talk to you if you want to talk to him. You know, it'll give you a little bit of access. But you know you're not going to influence this guy. But when someone writes a check for thousands of dollars, don't you think that there's an expectation that this guy better look out for what I want him to look out for? And that's the problem. You know, I made the point on someone's program not long ago. And in fact, I was in Washington. I do speaking engagements. And in fact, if you folks know of any such engagements, you can certainly reach me through my website, michaelcutler.net, and I'd love to do it. I work with a group, Alan Freed Associates. I've done a bunch of their seminars. It's always fun to go to Washington, and it also gives me a chance to meet with some friends on the Hill and discuss issues that are of great concern. I've been involved with this for so many years now. But, you know, if you just look at the way all of this stuff plays out in Washington, the analogy that I used was that when, let's say, a young woman who's hooked on drugs wakes up in the morning, her first thought is, how do I get the fix? When politicians get up, their fix is money because they need the money to win that next election. We have made it all but impossible for somebody without deep pockets or the backing of somebody with deep pockets to win elected office in America today. I was told by a guy who is now a member of a state legislature, because he had thought of running for Congress, that realistically, if you're going to run for a congressional seat, you better amass $1 million. $1 million. Think about that. The founding fathers of this country must be spinning in their graves like pinwheels. It was estimated that $1 billion was spent on the last presidential election. Who in blazes can get their hands on that kind of money, and who are they then beholden to once they win elected office? Look at the Chamber of Commerce. They're making demands on our government, and our government is acceding to their demands. The Chamber of Commerce is all about profitability for corporations. Now, don't get me wrong. I love to see companies that are well-managed make a profit. That's the American dream. I'm a capitalist, folks, okay? But when corporations want to make profit at the expense of the Americans, that's another story. I was contacted by a producer for a cable business station, and she called me up and said, are you willing to weigh in about immigration? And we spoke about all these issues about raiding workplaces and the E-Verify program and so forth. And by the way, I agree very much with E-Verify. The problem I have with H.R. 2164 isn't that it mandates E-Verify, but that it would preempt the states. And if it weren't for the states being out there, I don't think the feds would do anything. They won't do anything anyway. It's important that the states retain that right. And remember, the states never wanted to enforce the laws until they realized the feds weren't. But it goes beyond that, because the situation that we now have is that the Chamber of Commerce has told the government they want the visa waiver program expanded. Now, under the visa waiver program, an alien who seeks to enter the United States, this is when the visa is required, that foreign national first has to go to an American embassy or a consulate and fill out an application. There's about 40 questions that they have to answer. And then they make a decision whether or not to give that person a visa. In fact, there was a program called Visa Express that was being used where travel agencies, even in the Middle East, were just sending boxes of passports over to the embassies, and without conducting interviews, visas were being issued. That contributed to the ability of the terrorists to enter our country to attack us on 9/11. And other terrorist suspects were also identified as having entered that way. So one of the requirements that the 9/11 Commission came up with, and by the way, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission, was that they had to tighten up on the process by which visas are issued to foreign nationals. Now, that makes perfect sense. They're saying, you know, look through that peephole a little bit more carefully before you let these people in. And, you know, if an alien, for example, lies on that application for a visa, it's a felony. It's called visa fraud. If the visa fraud was committed just so the guy or the gal could come here, the penalty is a maximum of 10 years in jail. If the reason that person wanted to come here was to commit a crime, let's say rob a bank or extort some money or whatever, now we're up to a 15-year crime. If the crime that it could be shown they were coming to commit by committing visa fraud involved narcotics, now the penalty jumps to 20 years in jail. And if the penalty, if the crime involved international terrorism, well, now we hit the jackpot. The maximum penalty is 25 years in jail. Now, that makes perfect sense. Let's drop the safe on the heads of these bums that want to come here and do harm to us. But guess what? Under the visa waiver program, none of those penalties apply because there's no visa and there's less scrutiny. In fact, there was a story that was just published in the ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement website, about a citizen of Belgium who came to America 2 years ago or a year and a half ago under the visa waiver program, and you're supposed to leave after 90 days. Well, a year later, he's still here working illegally. But the Belgian government contacted our government and said, you got to get this guy, Andrew Vertunt, and arrest him because he's wanted back in Belgium for two crimes. Believe it or not, Paula, one crime was he raped a 12-year-old boy. The other crime was that he allegedly extorted money from somebody, 12,000 euros, it works out to about $17,000 in U.S. cash, by threatening to beat somebody up if he wouldn't give him the money. The guy's 31 years old. He was previously, 10 years ago, convicted of raping two other little children, I believe aged 11 and 12. So this guy is a monster. And we let him in under the visa waiver program. You have to wonder, did he attack anybody else while he was here? Maybe they didn't come forward. We were so concerned with opening up our doors to everybody. And why are we concerned? Because the Chamber of Commerce, the hotel and hospitality industries, and now the National Retailers Association want all the people they can get to come to America to fill those airplane seats, to sleep on those hotel beds, to order food in those restaurants, to attend the baseball games or the opera, or go to the tourist attractions, Disney World, SeaWorld, and maybe buy some trinkets. Well, I understand commerce, and I think that's wonderful, but you don't simply say, we don't care who these people are or what damage they might do to us as long as they come here. And that's what they're doing. And so, believe it or not, if you go to some of these websites, and again, if you go to my website, you can see some of these articles, michaelcutler.net, they actually spelled out how long it should take for a visa to be approved and what the ways are that they need to move more quickly. And right now, 36 countries participate in the visa waiver program. So the heck with America's security, the heck with our Fourth Amendment. We don't have that anymore, but we need more foreign nationals to come here. I mean, think about how crazy this is. We had that 95-year-old woman who was groped by a TSA employee because they said that they thought there was something in her diaper. She was wearing an adult diaper. The woman's 95 years old. She's in a wheelchair. So they grope this 95-year-old woman. Oh, my God, there's something in her diaper. Well, you know what, Paula? I hope it was brown and smelly, and I hope they got it all over themselves. I've never in my life heard of anything like that. But meanwhile, we have a dual national, an individual who's now an American citizen, also has a Nigerian passport, that they let get on board an airplane at least a couple of times. And now catch this, with a boarding pass that was from days earlier, and it's somebody else's name. Boy, I feel safe now. Did you see the latest story? They found some other one of these TSA characters who was stealing stuff out of people's suitcases. He was photographing them and uploading the photo to eBay, I guess it was. So by the time the person was on the airplane, this guy already had a buyer for the thing he just stole out of the guy's luggage. This is what passes for security in America today. Folks, we're not getting security from these nitwits. They spent over $1 billion on what was called the virtual fence. I was on Lou Dobbs a long time ago, and I had said, you know, that virtual fence will stop virtually nobody. Surprise, surprise, that's what happened. So after they gave Boeing over $1 billion and wasted I don't know how many years, they're now saying, oh, that virtual fence didn't work, but we can make it work, but it will take 10 to 15 years and God knows how many more billions. We went to the moon in 9 years. JFK established that as our goal, and we went. Today, we don't have a space program. I don't care what NASA says. As of right now, if the future of the world hinged on an American astronaut getting into space, he'd have to be standing out there with his thumb out, hoping he could bum a ride on a Russian or maybe a Chinese rocket, because we don't do that anymore in America. We don't manufacture anything in America anymore. Our school system is in the toilet. And the American dream, goodness, I don't even know where that has gone. And I hold we the people responsible, folks. Because if you're listening to me and you're getting upset and aggravated, then I'm doing my job. Because as I told Jim Sensenbrenner when he chaired the House Judiciary Committee, if I can't sleep at night, Mr. Chairman, sure as hell I don't want you being able to sleep at night. But I don't just want to keep you folks awake, because if I can keep you awake, then I'm going to tell you what your homework assignment is while you're pacing around your house tonight. Write a letter, send a fax or an email, make a phone call, contact the yo-yo who claims to be representing you in Congress, claims to be representing you in the United States Senate, claims to be representing you at the city council or the state assembly or wherever it is. Because I'll tell you, I'm no fan of politicians. I've had it up to here with politicians. I really have. People approached me and said, you should run for Congress after Mr. Weenie bit the bullet. My inclination is to run from Congress, not for Congress. But to be perfectly blunt, if we the people don't make our elected representatives sit up and take notice and tell them in clear terms what we expect, then we get the garbage that now passes for leadership in America. We don't go to a restaurant and say to a waiter or waitress, throw some crap on the plate and whatever it is, I'll eat it. We don't go to a car dealership and say, I need a new car, just put something in my driveway. We are very specific. We sit there discussing the options and sunroof, no sunroof, a stick shifter, an automatic, two doors, four doors, a minivan, hatchback, SUV, whatever. We're very specific. And if they don't have the car we want, we take our business elsewhere. If the restaurant doesn't prepare the food the way we want it, we take our business elsewhere. What I want to know from you folks who are out there listening to me, I would jokingly say, let me see a show of hands, but I can't find any humor in this, folks. How many of you are part of the problem? Because I'm going to tell you right now, I don't care what you think and I don't care how you believe. If you've never made those calls or if you haven't done it recently, shame on you. You're screwing it up, not only for yourself and for me and the other listeners out there. You're screwing things up for your children. This country has achieved more to provide the best possible future for the greatest spectrum of people than has any other country in the history of this planet. And the idea that we are just going to sit back passively and complain like crazy and then say, well, what are you going to do? Boy, oh boy, you know, the folks who defeated the Nazis and the fascists during the Second World War have come to be known as the greatest generation. At the rate we're going, folks, we're going to get our own little nickname. It's going to be America's last generation. We have the power. There are 300 million American citizens and 545 knuckleheads in Congress. Now, they're not all knuckleheads, but maybe I could count the good guys on the fingers of one hand. We put them there. If we put them there, we can take them out of there. We hire, we fire. There's an election coming, 2012. You want to get their attention? This is the time. Every single seat in the House of Representatives is literally up for grabs, okay? Every one of them. And a third of the seats in the United States Senate up for grabs, and most importantly, the White House is up for grabs. If you're not happy with the situation, what are you prepared to do about it? You know, Sean Connery asked the Kevin Costner character that question in The Untouchables. What are you prepared to do? I hope you are prepared to get your voices heard. I hope you are prepared to take an active role in the government of this country. And please don't tell me I'm just one voice. Those fires that have been ravaging New Mexico started with that first spark. The floods that have been devastating the middle of our country started with the first raindrop. Please don't tell me you are one voice. It always starts with one voice. When you go to the park and you see those statues of people on horseback, generally those statues were put up there to commemorate something that one person did at a moment in history that made all the difference in the world. You could be that person today who makes all the difference in the world. But I will guarantee you that if you don't get off your rear end and get involved, it won't happen. When I went to Brooklyn College here in New York City, I used to take the bus every day, and I try to get some homework done on the bus because I was working on two jobs and going to school. I was up to my eyeballs. And they had a wonderful sign. They used to have these advertisements on the bus at the top of the bus, just over the windows. And I will never forget this one advertisement for the Red Cross. It said, to the other guy, you are the other guy. If we keep waiting for somebody else to ride in on their white horse and take charge, it ain't going to happen, folks. The person that's going to make all the difference in this country is the person that you look at when you're brushing your teeth and stare into that mirror in your bathroom in the morning. That's who you and I and everyone else needs to depend on. We the people. Your thoughts, Paula?
It's going to take a lot of time to get the word out to people and to make them aware and to shake the tree, so to speak. I mean, it's like the lyrics written to a song back in the 40s. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. People need to take back their land, so to speak, and to, you know, make their voices heard and to, you know, not be afraid that they're not going to be heard, because they're heard when they're putting someone in office. Why wouldn't they think that they're not going to be heard when it comes to immigration matters or, you know, job loss matters or you know, the raising of taxes again? People think that they don't matter. you matter. Everyone matters. We all matter. So I wouldn't know what more I could say about that, you know.
No, you're right. And that's the point. We the people really need to feel empowered. And the problem is that we have become so convinced that we can't make a difference, but we can. We really and truly can. It's a matter of learning the truth. You know, when there's a revolution, when there's a coup in a country, the first thing the rebels do is they take over the news media. They take over the radio stations. News is so critical. You cannot have a viable democratic republic, folks, until or unless the citizenry are educated and informed. That's why propaganda is so important in dictatorships, to control information. How does anybody know anything that's happened in the world unless it happened on your street corner? You know, no one's going to know. You know, if you step outside, you see a car accident, you say, wow, there was a car accident. But you don't know if there was a car accident 5 miles from your house, let alone 3,000 miles from your house. The way you know is what the news reports on or doesn't report on. You know that famous thing about if the tree falls in the forest, there's no one there to hear it, does it make a sound?
Right.
The question is, if there's no one there to see it, but it's reported upon, then do you know about it? And the answer is, of course. But if nobody reports about it, then nobody knows that it happened. And that's why the news media is the problem also, because it forms public opinion. You know, it's interesting. Most TV and radio programs have a problem with the word alien. This is propaganda. The word alien is not an insult, and I confront people. They say, well, you're a racist if you want to enforce the laws. Really? Who's the most likely victim of the violence perpetrated by ethnic organized crime? And not just the Mexican cartels, folks. Not just MS-13. These are Latino organizations, okay? Certainly, the most likely victims are the members of the Latino community, mostly the immigrant community, but the Latino community. But, by the way, the Italian mob, who's most likely to get caught up in their violence? Italian Americans. You want to look at the Caribbean community, the Jamaican drug posses? Guess who the most likely victims are when there's a shooting? You turn on the news, people in the Jamaican immigrant community. Asian organized crime. In New York, we have the Flying Dragons and the Ghost Shadows, and sometimes they extort money, and they go into a restaurant because the guy didn't give money, guns blazing. Most likely people that are killed, Asian Americans. So to say it's racist to want to keep criminals out of our country, the immigration laws, folks, and I'm going to make this point because I can't make it often enough, you need to look at the law. And I don't want to get heavy on the law, but take out that crayon, Title 8 United States Code, Section 212, or just go to my website. You'll see the articles I've written about it. List the categories of aliens who are supposed to be kept out of the country. Aliens with dangerous communicable diseases, aliens who suffer mental illness and are prone to violence or sexual deviation, the pedophiles and so forth, convicted felons, human traffickers, narcotic smugglers, money launderers, prostitutes and pimps, human rights violators, war criminals, okay, members of violent gangs, Nazis. These are people who we're supposed to keep out of the United States. So when someone runs the border, you have to make a presumption they did that because they know that there's no way on God's green earth that we would let them in if we knew who they were and what they were up to. So how is it racist or how is it inhumane to say, look, I like people to come here, but not if they pose a threat to our well-being? And then they say, well, there's no legal way to come here. You know what, folks? Every year, 1.1 million plus aliens are provided with green cards. That means they are immediately on the pathway to United States citizenship. I'll just tell you this quickly. I started mentioning it before, and I want to make sure I make this as clear as I can. I was asked to be on a cable news-oriented program, and the person who asked me to come on the program, the producer, said to me, what do you think about the fact that we educate foreign students in America and then we send them home? Shouldn't we do what the Chamber of Commerce and so many other people have said, that we should staple a green card onto their advanced degree? And I said, see, I don't understand something. Why would you do that? She said, well, if we don't do that, Mr. Cutler, then these people go home, they work for companies that compete with our companies. And I said, you're part of a major network news program that specializes in business. I said, is there any major American company that really and truly isn't multinational in nature today? How many major companies, General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, GE, Westinghouse, Dell Computer, Microsoft, have offices all over the world, have factories all over the world? So what do you mean that if they go home, they won't be able to contribute to those companies? They certainly will be able to contribute to their companies, to those countries, companies, rather, I got it right the first time. But the better question is, why are we educating foreign students at all when American kids are losing their share of the American dream? My mother came to America from Poland ahead of the Holocaust. She didn't have the opportunities that she made sure I would have to go to college, because I was taught that a college education was the key to success in America. Why are we no longer looking at American kids and saying these children need the opportunity? We have turned America's children, especially the children of the poor and increasingly America's middle class, into collateral damage. Just because a child lives in poverty in Harlem or in Appalachia or some other place doesn't mean that that child isn't brilliant and doesn't have a strong desire to excel. It just means that because of economics, that person may never get to see the inside of a university unless he or she gets a job as a janitor. That's not the American dream. See? The problem is that we are taking the opportunities from Americans and providing them to foreign nationals. But I assure you that the countries from which those foreign nationals come, they won't provide Americans with opportunities. They want their people here. I believe that one of the reasons Mexico has built a fence to separate itself from Guatemala, forget all the screaming they do about our border with them, because they don't want Guatemalans coming to Mexico. Do you know why they don't want Mexicans, Guatemalans coming to Mexico, folks? Because the Guatemalans probably won't stay in Mexico. They will head for the United States. So what they're doing by putting up the fence is eliminating competition for their own citizens working illegally in the United States of America. Think about that. So here's this woman who's with a major business program on television saying to me, well, don't you think we should be giving these people permanent status and so forth? I said, what are we doing to educate American children? What are we doing to see to it that we staunch this flow of money out of our country, the foreclosure of American houses, which has a ripple effect and forces more housing prices down as more houses are dumped on the market and more abandoned homes are to be found in communities around the country, certainly making those houses near those abandoned homes less valuable and less desirable. This is a bunch of cascading dominoes. If we want to build up America, then we've got to create opportunities for Americans. That only makes sense. You know, I feel terrible for orphans, the idea that kids might be in orphanages or living in foster care. But no sane person would try to adopt an entire orphanage. No sane person gives money to charity if his own children are going to bed hungry at night. Today, the statistics came out showing that the unemployment rate is continuing to climb. What is our government doing to get more Americans back to work? And don't just tell me about creating jobs. How about making sure that Americans get those jobs? We, the people, have got to make those demands, folks. If we don't, the politicians, the people in power, will presume that we are either idiots, too stupid to matter, or in any event, nobody that they've got to be worried about. What worries politicians is when people make it clear that we are on to them. And that's what we have to do. Because if we don't make it clear to these politicians that we know what they're up to, they will continue on with this nonsense. We secure businesses and houses and so forth by putting bright lights around the buildings so that any untoward activity is easily spotted. The bright light that needs to shine on Washington is the bright light of truth. It starts with talk programs. It starts with people having conversations. It starts with Americans taking their citizenship seriously. We just celebrated America's birthday. Let's continue that spirit of celebration by trying to be the best citizens we can be so that we are also worthy of the unbelievable sacrifices of our men and women in the military. You know, I got to thank all of you for joining us this afternoon. It's a privilege to visit with you. I hope you've been finding it interesting and exciting. I certainly hope you visit my website, michaelcutler.net, or I hope you go to capsweb.org. But really, folks, let's all stay together on this issue. I don't care what your political orientation is. We can disagree. That's our right as Americans. But let's first and foremost remember that we are indeed Americans, and start doing that which is necessary to get the attention of our elected politicians. You know, think back to those old cell phone commercials. Can you hear me now? That's the question for Washington. Can you hear us now? Paula, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you and have you on, you know, guest hosting. And what you have to bring forth on the show is very important, and I hope our listeners, you know, take it to heart. And we did celebrate a very important holiday, and you know, when I was looking around, I noticed that everybody was happy and, you know, barbecuing, and they were happy for their freedom and their liberties, and a shout out to the troops that overseas that didn't get to come home and be with their families and their loved ones and their friends to celebrate that, because that's what's important, is they're still there after all this time fighting for our freedoms and our liberties, as well as the freedoms and the liberties and the countries that they've been assigned to. And, you know, you're forever in our hearts and in our minds. You're never forgotten, and we love you.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Paula, thank you again for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to be on with you.
Very welcome.
Well, folks, go have a great weekend, but please, if you have that time this weekend, set it aside. Send a letter to your congressman. Send a letter to your senator, your city councilman. But I think Washington really needs to get the heat right now. They're lonely. They really need to hear from us. So let's make sure we don't disappoint them. Everybody have a wonderful weekend. Thank you again for joining us on the American Hour. Look forward to being with you next week, same time, same place. Goodbye, everybody.
American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.